Hello everybody, welcome to episode 124 of Media Voices, the independent media podcast that tackles the business and ethics of publishing. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
And in line with that mission, we'd like to direct your attention to PressPad's Diversify the Media crowdfunding scheme, which aims to help get underrepresented groups into leading roles in the industry. So for instance, did you know that 94% of journalists in the UK are white and that only 0.4% are Muslim? So imagine just for a minute what a better state of affairs we'd be in if our journalists were more representative of the wider public.
PressPad are the ones that, they've got that scheme, isn't it, that you give rooms to interns who are looking to basically do internships in the media in London.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And in fact, we have a previous episode with PressPad co-founder Olivia Krellin, which we'll link to in the newsletter, which talks about exactly that and why it's so necessary. So for more information or to donate to this very worthy cause, you can visit diversifythemedia.com.
Yeah, we've had some amazing entries in for the Publisher Podcast Awards, but it's a busy time of year for publishers, so due to unexpected demand, we've actually extended their deadline for entries to the Publisher Podcast Awards. The entries now close this Friday, the 29th of November. You can get your entry pack and enter by going to publisherpodcastawards.com.
It's free! And this week on our interview, I'm speaking to Rachel Arthur. She's the founder of the independent magazine Boom Saloon, a boom project in the Boom Room. I caught up with Rachel recently in Las Vegas, where she was receiving the Rising Star in Media Award at the FIP Congress. Interestingly, there's a lot of crossover between what Rachel was saying about helping develop access to media and the creative industries and the work that PressPad is doing. So we've got a very worthy episode this week.
But before that, we're going to talk about something slightly less worthy, or rather a bunch of little less worthy stories under kind of this umbrella of the collapse of the information ecosystem and the profound risks that has for humanity. So a small topic, really. Peter, do you want to start by reading this quote out?
Well, this article, you know, Lydia Paul Green, editor-in-chief of HuffPost, wrote this thing for the Guardian, and I'm sure we're going to discuss whether it's spot on or not spot on, but there's a quote in there. Which is just so perfect for our times. She says, William Randolph Hearst owned the means of production and was free to publish made-up stories to sell papers and stoke the Spanish-American War. Today, everyone is free to be their own propagandist and by implication to stoke whatever friggin' personal little war they're choosing to support. This is terrifying. I found this piece terrifying.
Yeah. It is. It's scary. It's kind of, you know, you can, if you turn the dial one more click to the right, we are in full on like William Gibson dystopia levels of like societal collapse. And I think that was been brought into stark focus this week, just because we're entering election season, and so the interplay between the media and politics this week, you know, where people are so susceptible to quote unquote fake news and misinformation, it's so intense.
Well, the peak of this, for what I would describe as a left-leaning podcast, is the Tories. They changed the branding on their Twitter account to pretend to be a fact-checking website.
Yeah, people were rightly disgusted by that. They changed it from sort of, you know, conservative headquarters to Fact Check UK, in what was kind of a blatant attempt to mislead the public into thinking they were some sort of independent fact checker.
What is her argument for the information ecosystem actually collapsing?
Well, this could be an hour-long special. But her point is that social media has brought about this has made possible interference in political systems. It's undermined democratic elections, shaken trust in institutions. And we've got this world left, as she describes it, where people are free to choose their own facts. So that, I guess the point is that the kind of standards and ethics that were in place to manage journalism and manage publishing have gone out the window.
Okay, so I'm going to put a bit of a counterpoint to this. That actually, I think this whole collapse of the information ecosystem is a bit overplayed. It's like when people say, oh, you know, like, things are really, really awful at the moment. It's like, yeah, do you know what? We have some issues at the moment, but, you know, child deaths have gone down. Like, a lot of things have got better. Our access to medicine's better than ever. And it's the same with the information ecosystem. If you, you know, if you pedal back 100 years, information was controlled by small groups of people. if you wanted to put out propaganda, you would print your leaflets and hand them out in the street. And information was restricted to those, basically to the upper and middle classes.
There's one very, very important part you're missing here.
Okay.
Algorithms. Amplification. Amplification driven by algorithms. And that, I think, Chris's favourite quote, a lie can be halfway around the world before truth's got its boots on, has just been absolutely turbocharged by the algorithms.
But is the issue there that the less that the information ecosystem has collapsed and more that we have no education about
how to
tell the difference and how to understand the difference between, I hate the term fake news, but how to understand the difference between what is real and what is not.
Yeah,
I think that's... Because our access to information is better than ever, and I would hate to ever see that taken away.
I think it's... I mean, you're exactly right. It's you have access to more information, but as you said, people are less able to parse what is real and what isn't. The information ecosystem now prioritizes the creation of information of any quality, because that's how people make their money, through advertising.
Social media is a difficult beast, but the other thing that we can do today, and which is exactly what happened with that conservative Twitter, is that when the powers that run the world play up, we can hold them very publicly and very loudly accountable.
Nah, but that gets ignored. I think, like you said, the people that are calling them out are on Twitter. Have you seen any reports anywhere in the Tory?
I saw quite a few articles on, and actually I saw some people saying that the only way they'd found out about it was because they'd read articles in the news about it, not because they were on Twitter.
And I think the problem with that is we're getting into sort of the fact-checking aspect, and that's that quote about, you know, a lie being able to run around the world before the truth has got its boots on, because fact-checking after the fact doesn't work. It doesn't get anywhere near the pickup that the initial false claims do. Okay, and that's not a purely social media thing. That's just how people consume the news these days.
Let me put this another way. I think the information ecosystem and the way it's distributed is unbalanced at the moment, and we need to work hard as an industry to rebalance it. But I don't think we're in an age of information ecosystem collapse. I think that's been melodramatic.
I also think that this article puts the blame squarely on Google and Facebook, and that's an argument we've heard debunked before.
And you're right, putting the collapse of the revenue at Google and Facebook's feet is wrong. We've talked about that so many times. It's kind of blame shifting, but you can't deny we have there's an American president in place because of the algorithms. There's no other way you can actually look at that.
I don't know, you know, because people do tend to swing back the other way when... So Obama, he had many faults, but he was a liberal president. He introduced a lot of forward-thinking, you know, programs for social good. And I think that inevitably, if you look, you know, historically, people do tend to swing the other way when they feel that they have been victimized, even though really what that is just their privilege being stripped away.
And I think that people writing stories and stuff in Macedonia about various things Hillary was up to, I think that it played a part, but the biggest thing about Trump's rise to power is that he went straight to the people.
Oh, I don't know, man.
As much amplification was done by what we think of as the mainstream media as was done by social media. And you can see the same thing with kind of this weird misinformation campaign that the Tories are trying, where they'll put out, you know, kind of deliberately bad social stuff in the knowledge that people will share it, even if it's just to say, oh, this is bollocks, because they're crowding out this attention ecosystem.
Like Labour mobilised social media in a big way in the last election, and I've heard them say they're going to do the same thing, where it was memes that they were farming out for that, and they were basically just saying, you know, distribute it to as many people. What do they call them? Internet warriors they had for theirs.
Oof, that's a bit scary.
Well, it just makes me think of Mad Max.
You two are just like the social media equivalent of climate deniers. This is awful. How can we even be on the same podcast?
This is that is the worst thing you have ever accused me of.
Wow.
Cap fits.
Social media has caused huge, huge problems, but we can't blame everything on social media and algorithms.
No, ultimately, who I blame is people.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, definitely people's fault. But listen, when you're sat in your bunker eating your own shoes, you're going to come back to this episode and you're going to be like, what the actual...
I mean, I'm currently huddling under a sleeping bag on a futon, so it's not that much different.
Yeah, well...
Well, should we talk about some of the individual examples of misinformation this week?
Well, what's the point? Because it's not relevant. You guys don't think it has any part to play. This whole episode's meaningless.
And now for the news in brief. Reach, who are formerly Trinity Mirror, who are also the publishers of the Mirror, Express and Star, have said that they will launch 7 new regional news websites next year and recruit 46 journalists in a significant expansion of their digital network.
Excellent.
So that's jobs and launches of regional news, which is great.
This is just fantastic. And you can see why they're doing it, because they are kind of where they've targeted for these new newspapers. Rather, news websites, you know, the ones where there is provision, where their rivals are kind of pulling back. But this is just fantastic news. This is exactly what you want to see. You don't want to see news deserts like we have in the US.
No. Any deserts like they have in the US. Which are coming soon, you know, if the climate emergency keeps going.
We're nearly there. And Reach PLC has also reportedly pulled out of negotiations to acquire JPI's regional titles, which we reported on last week. So this is according to the Financial Times, who note that the front runner is now NewsQuest.
Dun dun dun. Talking of NewsQuest, Gannett is looking to make deep cost reductions across its organisations after merging with Gatehouse, but journalist jobs will apparently be spared. And the checks in the post.
That's never going to happen, I'm afraid.
It's a weird one. NewsQuest is owned by Gannett, yeah?
Yeah, there are some, yeah.
And Minute Media have acquired the Players Tribune, which is a sports brand which gives a voice to athletes. We had their CEO, Asaf Peled, on a few weeks ago, and he was talking about what he was looking for in an acquisition. So, yeah, that's nice that that's come off.
Yay. Google, the latest tech giant to crack down on political ads. This is another area that we should be talking about, guys. About our personal politics, targeted and all that. Political advertisers will no longer be allowed to target voters based on their political affiliation on Google. Although, there's a lot of questionable stuff they can still be targeted on.
I don't know what... I know it's building up a profile, but I don't know what my political leanings would, you know, mean that they thought they could sell me stuff based on, you know?
I don't know how Google would know your political leanings unless searching for manifestos and stuff.
Oh, almost certainly what you're reading, like all the articles and whatever media you read, surely.
Yeah, they probably just add a different weight to a bunch
God,
of different...
I'm such a simple soul, am I?
Facebook can guess your political leanings.
Yeah, well, Facebook would know my political leanings because I'm usually ranting with some Boris Johnson as a tool post.
Well, this is where you kind of think that Amazon has the ultimate kind of advantage here, because they know purchase data. They have kind of that purchase history, and Google doesn't really have that to the same extent. So Amazon can target items to me much more effectively than Google ever could, you know, no matter what my political leanings were.
And yet, that toaster is still following you around the web.
Digital-only subscriptions for news and magazine media have doubled from 10 million to 20 million in 1.5 years, according to the latest Global Digital Subscription Snapshot report from FIP and Solera One. So I think we touched on this a little bit last week with one of the other reports that came out. But again, good news for subscriptions.
Bad news. Sports Illustrated are cutting back print publishing to just once a month. No big surprise, given all the stuff that was going on over there. But they will keep doing special editions.
So according to NBC News, though, in early October, The Athletic had tried to save Sports Illustrated by offering $50 million to license that content from Authentic. So it sounds like people saw this coming and wanted to kind of ameliorate it a bit.
I don't know. I think it was... I'm sure if we go back to the episode that we talked about this in, we said that this was a likelihood.
Yeah.
And even if we didn't, we can go back in and add it.
Yeah, no, let's not add to the misinformation crisis.
Okay. This week I spoke to Rachel Arthur, founder of independent magazine Boom Saloon. We spoke about Boom Project's mission to democratise creativity and support access to the media, and her Boom Room agency. We spoke about missions, motivations, and staying true to yourself, about what she means by democratising creativity, and firstly, about the Rising Star in Media Award she won at the FIP Congress in Las Vegas. I'm in Planet Hollywood in Las Vegas with Rachel Arthur. Rachel, why are you in Las Vegas?
I am very happily here to attend FIPS World Congress, and last night I picked up an award for being a rising star in media.
Well done.
Thank you. Which was very, very nice. I was highly commended last year, and then bumped up this year. So yeah, a really, really nice end to the year.
So what's the award? How do they define the sort of, what they're looking for the people that won that award?
So a lot of it is around new initiatives within media and publishing. So in a couple of weeks, it will be a year since I went full-time on Boom. It was always a bit of a side hustle previously. And this year has been a really interesting one because, as I said in my application, it's been largely about kind of firming things up behind the scenes. So working a lot to tighten up the business model, think more about revenue streams and consider new initiatives, which is, I mean, I'll just be totally frank about things, is something I find really challenging because I'm consistently thinking of people on the outside looking in and the traditional measurements of output and how many publications and how many projects. But now that this is a full-time thing, there's so much extra to think about. You know, I've said we have such a strong purpose and mission, which is always at the core of everything that we do. But with a sensible, sustainable hat on, I can't be a martyr to make that happen, yeah. Or it will cease to exist.
Yeah. You need to make 11.
Exactly. The foundations need to be strong. So that's what a large part of this year has been about, alongside working on this new initiative around social distribution, which I don't know, I can maybe touch on more later if that's of interest. So yeah.
Well, before go on, talk about what you do. What's the product, Boom Saloon? What is it?
Mm-hmm. So Boom Saloon is part of a triple-stranded business. It's a print magazine which has a mission to democratize creativity for good. So how we do that is we work with a really, really broad spectrum of contributors, from students and people who have never been published before, right up to the kind of industry experts and the people who are considered to be at the top of their game. And within that spectrum, what we really push for is people who feel quite ostracized from the creative industries. So a lot of people who personally feel, within quotation marks, that they don't have the right kind of education, status, they don't know the right people. And that's where I feel we have this amazing opportunity to come along and say literally none of that matters. Yeah. If you're doing something creatively of merit, then we think it should be recognised and showcased on the same page as the people who are seen as being at the top of their game, and championed in a publication that's sold all around the world. And then that whole concept is furthered by the second strand of the business, which is our projects. So they work mostly with young people in areas of deprivation. We build upon a concept called asset-based community development, or ABCD, which essentially means we identify a community within which we recognise one or a series of assets who have these sparks of potential but often don't realise they exist, don't realise they could be a genuine career path. Often it's something that they're hiding, because we're working with a lot of young people facing challenges. Quite often they have this incredible talent, but it's very much behind closed doors.
So is that idea of an asset is the talent? The talent is the asset?
Yeah, exactly. So that could be any kind of creative endeavour, creative pursuit whatsoever. Right. It's just about how we open people's eyes to this potential that they have within themselves and work with them. A lot of what we want to do is around legacy and this idea of transferable skills. Absolutely the worst thing that we could do with the projects is fall into this way of thinking of parachuting into a community that we're not a part of, running a project once, leaving, and that's the end of it.
Yeah.
So with each and every project, the whole process is opened up to every single person. They're talked through every single step of it. Sometimes, you know, they're not the biggest fan of that kind of things. Trying to teach young kids about invoicing, they don't want to know, but the idea is that we have equipped them with every single step of the way to be able to then take this and replicate it themselves. I don't see much use in running something which isn't going to leave some kind of lasting imprint on people. It's this whole idea of, you know, if a man starving, you can either throw a fish at his feet or you can teach him how to catch it himself. So yeah, that's really what we want to do.
So you're based in Edinburgh?
Mm-hmm.
But the project's all in Edinburgh, or do you work in other places?
Very much in other places. So the first one was based in Edinburgh, largely for realistic expectations. So like I say, I wasn't full-time on this then. Tiny team, even tinier budgets. In spite of that, I'm so proud of what we achieved. So yeah, Edinburgh-based for the first project, Glasgow-based for the second, and we're actually in the throes of planning our first ever international project at the moment, which will be taking place in Berlin. Yeah, and the really nice aim with the projects is that we want to be able to open these doors internationally between all these different communities who might, in theory, you know, a lot of them are dealing with issues around isolation and feeling very much like they're in a certain silo and they are placed within this box. Whereas if we can be the conduit that opens these doors internationally for them, to me, that's only ever going to be a positive. So, yeah.
So what's the link between the magazine and the project? How are they tied together?
So as I was saying, the business is triple-stranded. The projects sit in the middle, and on either side is Boom Saloon, the print magazine, and then the Boom Room, our creative studio. And all profits raised from both of those funnel directly into the projects.
Right.
But the kind of overarching umbrella over all of them is this idea of using media as a force for good and trying to democratize the whole industry. So that's the common thread that ties them all together. But, you know, and kind of a more, I suppose, business model type sense, Boom Saloon and the Boom Room both financially make possible Boom projects.
Right. So that idea that media is a force for good kind of flies in the face of a bunch of stuff that's going on at the moment.
Yeah, hopefully.
Do you find people sceptical or supportive?
I'd say hopeful, which is great, especially because this is something I'm so obsessed with. I'm so interested in the history of the media, and to me, you know, historically, it's such a position of privilege to be within the media, and you were looked to as this, you know, this beacon of trust and influence and power, and, you know, it was categorically, media was there to report the facts. Mm. And I feel like lately we've moved from that stance. It's really interesting, and I think it's an incredible platform to, you know, voice debates and hear different opinions. But obviously there are all the negatives that come along with that as well, which are definitely much more at the forefront of everything that's happening right now. So if we can do something to combat that, then, yeah, that's a dream.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a few newspaper editors that could maybe learn something from it, to be honest. Media is a force for good.
Yeah.
So the Boom Room, tell me about that. What's the story there? What are you trying to do with that?
So that's our creative studio where we offer design, editorial and strategy work to clients all around the world. So that could be anything from creating a new brand identity, print campaign, digital campaign, strategic positioning workshop, any combination of those three things, essentially. Because what, you know, I suppose in a more cynical way, but you can think of it because this is a tried and tested model, Boom Saloon, our print publication, is essentially a calling card of what we can do.
Yeah.
That ties together the design, the editorial and the strategy. Everything is done in-house. So any potential clients can look at that, pick any of those three elements and be like, we want you to replicate that for us. It's also arguably the most financially viable aspect of the model.
Well, I think there's a lot of indie magazines in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm thinking Delayed Gratification does infographics.
Yep.
Hot Rum Cow used to do publications.
Yep.
So it's that model that almost at the magazine is your brochure. It's like the best looking brochure in the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do people talk about it like that? Or do you talk about it like that?
To be perfectly frank, no, because that's not why it was started. It was started with I almost hesitate to use the word purer, but essentially a much purer mission than that. Boom Saloon is for the community, it's for our contributors, it's for everyone that we work with. There is very much a reason why my face isn't plastered everywhere, right, because yeah. it's not something that belongs to me, it belongs to everyone that creates it. And in the same vein, it will never, never be purely something which is created as an advert for what we can do. But it is nice to be able to have a physical, tangible product which showcases that.
So it has a value or a position in itself. What is that position? What are you trying to say with the magazine?
Well, I think everything is tied into this concept of democratizing creativity, and how we can remove those barriers which are so, so prevalent at the moment. I was having a really interesting discussion with someone earlier about whether or not they have always been in place, and yeah. the fact that, you know, I think there are a lot of issues with accessibility within the creative industries currently. That's not to say that it can't be done, but I think it's very far from a level playing field, and you shouldn't give up on the fight until that is the case.
I mean, so you know the Press Pad initiative, where people will lend, if you like, a spare room to journalists,
okay,
or trainee journalists, or young journalists coming yeah. up, particularly in London.
Mm-hmm.
And is that the kind of idea? That idea that you're not giving people a handout or whatever, but you're trying to make it easier for them to show what they've got.
Yeah, to some extent, there is something very much ingrained in everything we stand for, which is this concept of quality and of being to a certain standard. I strongly believe that you do people a massive disservice if you add in any concepts of pity or charity.
Yeah,
I
definitely.
Don't think it's right to look down on people and say, poor you, you've had a terrible time. You know what, we'll lower the barriers to entry, we'll lower the standard for you to make up for that.
Affirmative action or whatever you call it.
Yeah, that's ridiculous, that's discrimination, yeah. and I just don't think that there is a place for that as we move forward. So we're very much of an opinion that there is such incredible talent across the board, and I think not laziness, but you know, maybe a sense of everyone's time poor at the moment, right? So you want to go for the quick wins, whereas what we want to try and do is take the time to find those unexpected voices who would never normally come to us or other publications, and work to support them and nurture them and give them a platform to shout about the incredible things that they do. So yeah, time consuming but definitely worth it.
What's that process? How do you identify those people?
Oof. It's one of the main questions people ask us, and it's so, so varied. I am out there a lot, looking at all sorts of different things, pounding the pavements. There's the dream is when there's crossover between one of the three different strands. So if we are working with an incredibly talented young person for the projects who has some kind of overlap with the magazine, or they can open up a whole new community of their friends and contacts who then could cross over to the magazine as well. Social media is a big one for us, because we work with contributors from all around the world. Like I say, very small team. Not much time, not much money. There's no chance of jetting around the world to go and find people. But social has been really, really great for us. Also working with other incredible platforms. So there's something called Native Photograph, who are based in Brooklyn. And they work to champion photographers from challenging backgrounds all around the world. And they do such amazing work. And, you know, tapping into a network such as them opens doors to a whole secondary bunch of amazing talents. So yeah, it's a really varied mix, but a lot of it is us going to find the people as opposed to taking submissions from the people who are submitting to every other publication.
Right. So you've actually got to go and look for them rather than they're knocking on the door. Do you think that'll change? Do you think you'll get more people coming?
Yeah, it's. I mean, it was a decision very early on never to publicly open up for submission, because we have this policy to offer everyone who submits work a personal response. If they're not right for us, we signpost them to a different publication which they will be right for, which can be quite time consuming, but it's really important and is so, you know, when we think of our purpose and our mission, it's like I said earlier, some decisions are just made for you instantly, and that is one of them, because it's all about supporting people from all different backgrounds who are submitting their work, and it's a brave thing to do. But something that we've noticed recently is the mushroom effect of our network, who, you know, you'll have someone who is just starting out, has never submitted work before. We collaborate with them. They then think this is incredible because it's the first time they've been in a tangible piece of print, which is around the world. So they then shout about that to all of their friends, who then think, oh, I want that too. I'll get in touch. So more and more we're having people come to us, which is great. But we can never lose the element of finding those unheard voices.
So I'm going to ask a big question. Do you pay these people? Do you pay your contributors?
Yeah. It's we've been very transparent about this from day one. It's very much a nominal fee. Yeah. We've always paid as much as we possibly can. But because all of the profits from Boom Saloon directly support the projects and we're a non-profit, it's always been tight. And like I say, it is a nominal fee. What's incredible is a lot of our contributors refuse payment because of what we do, which, you know, obviously makes things easier for us, but also is a really nice feeling because people understand what we're trying to do and support that, which is incredible. We've always said that we want the fees to consistently rise, and as we move towards more of a sponsorship type model, the hope is that that will kick in even faster. But yeah, it's a consistent challenge. We don't run advertising. It's a very weighty publication with great paper stock, so it's very expensive to print. So yeah, consistent challenge, but something that we're always trying
Why
to
Why don't you run advertising?
So in the traditional iteration, it doesn't align with a lot of the things that we stand for.
Right.
We, you know, this idea of democracy is at the core of everything that we do. We work with a lot of people who have very little disposable income. We do a lot of pay it forward magazines. So people who would want to be a part of our readership can be without the idea of things being a free handout. But I think if you then try and marry that up with a splashy advert for, I don't know, £1,000 coat or whatever it may be, it belittles a lot of the hard work that we've done previously. Also, our content is very much evergreen. Nothing is trend-led or gossip or newsworthy. Nothing's time-stamped. We still sell copies of issue one, which was from late 2016. Yep. So if you imagine someone reading that now and it has an advert from that time period, the publication instantly feels dated. Also, you know, realistically, we have a tiny print run. When you're speaking to advertisers, they want those big numbers, and we don't have them. So for multiple reasons, it's not right for us. This idea of strategic partnerships, however, potentially is, and it's a model that we are currently looking at, which is really exciting for us, because if we strategically align with the right people, then I think that can be a very powerful move. But we just have to approach it in a way that stays true to everything that we stand for.
So you talk a lot about that, staying true to what you stand for and your mission and all these things. That I get when I'm hearing that comes from you. What are you getting out of this? Because you've said it's non-profit, so you're not getting rich, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
What do you get from it?
I love it.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's funny, the mission and the purpose and the community, that is the number one, and it always will be. But as I said to you earlier, I'm so aware of the fact I can't be a martyr for this or it won't continue. But over and above that, if I was miserable doing this, you know, why? Like, it's a massive challenge every single day. And I think one of the only reasons that it can continue is that I bloody love it so much. And to be able to do something that you love, I think, is such a privilege. And to get to work with the people that we get to work with is such an honour. So, yeah, it's incredibly hard, but I also think I'm incredibly lucky to even be able to consider doing that. So
compared to other jobs you've had?
Yeah.
Not naming any names.
I've had some great jobs and some terrible jobs. I still maintain this is the best job by far, but a close second was working at Garden Centre. That was cracking. Loved it. Absolutely loved it.
I've just invented a new feature for the Media Voices podcast. Other jobs you love.
My number one, and I've said this quite a lot, if everything goes down the pan, I'm going to be a florist.
Yeah.
No funerals. Mm. Only celebrations, which, you know, will kill any kind of money that I want to make, but that's the plan.
So the last question we ask everybody, and you can think about this, mm-hmm. What was the last piece of media that you read or watched or listened to that you absolutely loved and would recommend to our listeners?
A book called Emergent Strategy. Oof. Which I've only just started, but you know when you have I've this is a crazy admission for an editor and publisher, but I went through a phase where I was not reading very much at all, which is nuts. And I think, I don't know if it was, you know, when you're studying, you're forced to read so much, but then you move into this realm where that's something you love. And I was still buying print and flicking, but I wasn't reading anything in depth. And then, you know, there are all these articles that come out about how you can read 20 books a month, and here's all these speed reading tips and tricks and all this kind of crap that probably doesn't lead to anything. But I read quite an interesting piece that was saying, you know, go back to taking a pencil with you and underline things that matter to you. Make notes in books, make them yours, which I love the concept of. And anyway, this book, Emergent Strategy, I had to stop because literally every sentence was bloody underlined and starred, and it's just a mess. But yeah, really interesting read.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
So as we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, we've actually extended the deadline for entries to the Publisher Podcast Awards until the end of this week, the 29th of November. So if you go across to publisherpodcastawards.com, you can download an entry pack. You can check out our amazing list of judges that you're trying to impress with your podcast. And yeah, hit enter for a chance to win a coveted PPA, but not that PPA trophy.
If you want to stay in contact with us during the week, don't forget that we have a newsletter which goes out every Wednesday. It includes a link to the latest episode, a curated list of what we're reading from around the web. That's just kind of a nice way to stay in contact, and you can get that by going to our website.
And the website's at voices.media, and on the website there's all our episodes and a bunch of other stuff that we've written, and links to our social media, which is primarily Twitter, because we like Twitter, because we like being just with the journalists and not with the great unwashed. Twitter account is at Media Voices Pod.
But until next week, when we're going to be back with a fantastic guest, hopefully a slightly more focused look at all the news and views from around the media world. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Stop social media's influence on Brexit.